Alright, so it's 2 o'clock, I guess we can get started. In case nobody told you, Richard is out of town today and he asked me to give a substitute lecture. So these are some slides that Richard gave me and I'm going to do my best to go over them without making any errors in terms of what he had intended. There are a couple of differences between what will appear on the screen and I think what's in the copies, just because I found a couple of typos as I was going through this. Anyway, so the reading for today's material is the usual Astrom and Murray source. I guess we're doing things that are in Chapter 2. And the general idea of today's lecture is to talk about modeling using ordinary differential equations, to do that both in sort of a general context of seeing what's the range of different applications in which it makes sense to use differential equation models, and then also to look at some particulars of second-order systems because they are so important for basic control applications, and also because they're sort of a good model system in which you can actually do some analytic calculations. And then towards the end, we'll see some sort of current applications of these sorts of ideas. We won't be able to go too much into the technical details, but hopefully it will give you a flavor for, again, the generality of what you can do with these sorts of models. So the first few slides in the lecture are meant to be a review of things that you should recognize. They're from Math 1 or Physics 1 or whatever the equivalent courses you might have taken if you're here as a graduate student. Second-order differential equations, the idea is we're looking at actually second-order linear differential equations. So we're considering equations of this form. So here, Q is the configuration variable. So if you like, you can think in terms of a mechanical example where we have a mass spring damper system. So if the mass is M and the spring constant is K, and then the damping dashpot or whatever has a damping coefficient, in this equation it's C, then the unique configuration variable for this thing, if it's only moving in one dimension, is the either the position of the block away from the anchor point of the spring, or equivalently you could think of it as describing the extension of the spring. And then we may want to consider the dynamics of such a system, both under the influence of the mass, the inertia mass, the spring, and the dashpot, but also perhaps there's an external forcing term, F of T. So there is just that single configuration variable, Q. However, if we want to write down the dynamical equations for this system, we find that we need to bring in a couple of other things, namely the time derivative of Q, that is the velocity of this thing, and also the acceleration of this block, right? Because that's what has to go into this inertia term from F equals ma. So the equation that we write down is just mq double dot plus cq dot plus kq is equal to F of T. So these are the external forcing terms. This kq is there to represent the restoring force of the spring. CQ dot is the damping term, and MQ double dot is the inertia term for the mass itself. So hopefully what you remember is that when you look at differential equations like this, so first of all, we call it second order because there's a second time derivative on the left-hand side, but it's linear, right? Because the variables that we care about there, which are Q, Q dot, and Q double dot, those things only appear multiplied by constants. And the forcing term that's there is an additive forcing term in the sense that it doesn't multiply any of those dynamical variables. So when faced with a differential equation of that form that we want to solve, hopefully you remember that it's useful to think about splitting the solution into two pieces. So there's a homogeneous part of the solution, and there's a particular part of the solution. The idea there is if we just want to ask, under the influence of some forcing term, what is the mass doing? How does it move around? Well, there are actually kind of two different contributions to that that you'd like to be able to separate out. One is that even in the absence of any forcing, if you start the initial condition of the system away from its equilibrium point, right? So if we either stretch or compress the string, spring away from what its equilibrium extension is, or say we give the mass an initial velocity, right? Those are non-equilibrium initial conditions, and so even if we don't apply any extra forces, the thing's going to wobble around for a while before it eventually settles down. Right, so that part of the dynamics is basically just showing you how the initial conditions that you set kind of ring down and settle. And then there's going to be the particular part that we'll talk about on the next slide, which has to do with the sort of actual influence of this external force. So to just get the homogeneous solution for an equation of this kind, the simple thing you can do is just set F of T is equal to 0. And since this is a nice linear equation, you can basically guess the overall form of the solution. Those of you who have looked at these sorts of things before will recognize that except in special cases when we have certain degeneracies, you know that the overall dynamics is going to look like trig functions, possibly with exponential damping. So we can write down a trial solution of this form. So we'll say, well, Q of T, so the position of the mass is a function of time, it's probably going to oscillate. So we can have cosine and sine terms at some frequency omega, and those relative amplitudes of those two guys will be A and B. And then we want to allow there to be an overall damping term e to the alpha t, where we expect alpha will probably be less than zero, since we're taking away the forcing terms for now, and we just have this damping coefficient c. Damping coefficient is b over here in the diagram, it's c in the equation. So the general simple way that we can solve for the parameters that appear in the solution, and indeed to convince ourselves that this form of the solution is reasonable, you just take this form of q and t, q of t, and plug it into the terms on the left-hand side. So remember, we've set this to zero, so it's very easy to go in here and see how this q pops into the left-hand side of that equation. So the kq term is obvious. We just multiply this by k, stick it in. The cq dot term, we just take this thing, take the time derivative. So we've got two parts here. So we know that the time derivatives are both going to pull down alphas, and they're also going to turn the cosines and sines into each other, and they're going to pull out some omegas. And then the q double dot term, we just take yet another time derivative, so we'll expect to end up with some alpha squareds, and likewise we'll expect these omegas to come out twice in some places as well. Right? So if you just do that and then kind of regroup terms, you note that there's always going to be this exponential term sitting out to the left in this contribution, that contribution, and that contribution, right? Because there's no way that you can get rid of it just by taking time derivatives. So we can imagine just pulling that thing all the way out to the left, and then with what's left over, it's very useful to group together the coefficients of cosine omega t and sine omega t, because if this thing on the right-hand side is going to be equal to zero, right, which is what you want for plugging this trial solution into that differential equation, then the coefficients of the sine and the cosine term have to vanish separately, right? Because since those two things are orthogonal in time, there's no way that they can cancel each other out. Each one of them has to disappear on its own. And so even though we had that exponential term sitting out common to all of these, if you can get all this stuff on the inside to go away, then that thing won't matter. So if you use this condition that the coefficients of the cosine and the sine have to independently disappear, that just leaves you with these algebraic equations, which have in them parameters that specify the problem, like the mass, the damping coefficient, and the spring constant. But then it's also got these things like omega, alpha, A, and B, right, which are just free parameters that we left in our trial form of the solution. But if you solve for those things, the claim is that you can then solve for alpha and omega in terms of other stuff. And then the additional equations that you need to nail down everything else come from the initial conditions, right? So the idea of this homogeneous solution is we're trying to write down a part of the solution that captures the way that the initial conditions ring down, and so we have to specify what those initial conditions are. So there's some initial position that we impose onto this system, and if you look at the trial form of the solution, when we set t equal to 0, this is just 1, that's 0, that's 1, and so therefore A is the thing that fixes our initial condition. Likewise, the initial velocity that we give the system is the time derivative of this thing, and that ends up being we evaluated at time t equals 0, and then it ends up giving us A alpha plus B omega. Right, so between all of these three equations, you can basically solve for all the coefficients that appear in there, and you find that the general solution is going to look like this. So the exponential damping term out front does indeed turn out to be negative for reasonable values of these parameters, and you find that the kind of coefficient in terms of the in front of the cosine is telling you what the initial position is. It's easy to see. Something over here gives you sort of determines then what the initial velocity is, and then this thing is telling you how that initial oscillation will damp down. One thing you want to be careful about in looking at this this expression is that there's a funny degenerate point that can happen when this parameter zeta, defined thusly, if that thing is actually equal to 1, you're at kind of a funny critical damping point, and so you actually need to do something more subtle. But for any other value of the damping term, this is fine. Okay, so that's the homogeneous term. Right, so the idea there is, since this is a linear differential equation, if you want to think about the response of the system both with arbitrary initial conditions and with some forcing term f of t, we can solve those two things separately and add them together. So we've got our homogeneous part, and now what we want to do is also think about how to derive the response of the system to various kinds of forcing terms. Now, two particular kinds of forcing terms that we're going to want to look at in detail are the a step input and a sinusoidal input. And you can, in fact, do more general things, but they're kind of messy, so we won't really consider them too closely today. So what we mean by a step input Oh, by the way, you know, since we're talking in this slide about the particular response, the idea is that the homogeneous part takes care of the initial conditions. So when we're talking about the particular response, we set the initial conditions to zero. That is, we imagine that the system is just starting out from equilibrium. So, and then usually when you talk about the step response of some sort of a dynamical system, you usually mean the step response with zero initial conditions, right? So we're really just talking about the kind of inherent way that the system reacts to a step input. So the idea of the step input is that up till time t equals zero, you just imagine that the thing is sitting there at equilibrium, and so the way things are defined, the equilibrium position coordinate of the mass is zero. Likewise, at equilibrium, you should have zero velocity. And so the step input just says that, well, at time t equals zero, suddenly turn on a constant value of the force, f of t is equal to some constant capital F. Right, so a way that you can imagine that in principle is that, well, suppose that this block has some electric charge, and at t equals zero, we turn on an electric field pointing in, say, this direction that tries to pull it out. And so we turn on that electric field, but then we just keep it constant. And so you can sort of imagine what's going to happen just in your head, right? So in the absence of that electric field, we said that the equilibrium position was zero. If we now suddenly turn on an extra force, the new equilibrium position, if we just wait for the thing to kind of ring down and settle, we expect the new equilibrium position to be out here someplace. Right, because basically you will extend this spring until the restoring force of the spring is equal to the pulling force of the applied electric field. But sort of at short times, what you expect to happen is that if you suddenly just, you know, turn on this electric field, it's going to kind of come out, maybe it overshoots, and then it wobbles a little while, and you have to kind of get rid of all that transient oscillation through this damping term. So anyway, it's not very hard to calculate exactly how that response goes. Leave it as an exercise to do this for yourself. But what you find then is that the particular response to a step input is this thing given here, Q of t is equal to all this stuff. And what you find is that if you just to verify your intuition, if you let t go to positive infinity in the solution, you note that, well, this oscillation is bounded. This is an exponential decay that will go to zero. This oscillation is bounded. That's an exponential decay that goes to zero. So in the long term, what you should have is that this whole term is just one, because that's the only thing that survives. And indeed, the place that you end up with in terms of the equilibrium position is proportional to the magnitude of the applied force. And this thing is... so this omega naught squared times m is actually k, the spring constant. So the equilibrium condition is k times the equilibrium position is equal to f. And that's exactly the balancing condition, that your applied force pulls you one way and the spring tries to restore you in the other. The other common type of input to consider is a sinusoidal input. So if you say that the applied force is now some amplitude capital A times sine of omega t, where I should point out this particular omega doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the natural response frequency of this system. So I think somewhere in the last slide, things got changed up a little bit. So yeah, you'll note that the way that the actual homogeneous solution is written down is in fact in terms of both some omega naught, which is the sort of natural resonance frequency of this system if you ignore the damping. Then there's sort of the kind of damped resonant response of the thing, which is this omega d. So, you know, those are sort of natural or characteristic response frequencies for the system. But when we talk about the sinusoidal input, the idea is that we allow this omega to be whatever we want. Right? And so, again, the way that you can apply that sort of a forcing term is if you imagine the block there is charged, we just apply some electric field which is oscillating in magnitude and direction. So it's a convenient property of linear systems that when you force them sinusoidally, the particular response is also sinusoidal. And in fact, the frequency of the response is the same as the frequency of the applied force. Right? So the form of the particular solution looks like Q of t is equal to some m, which is the magnitude of the response, the gain of the response, I guess, times the amplitude of the applied force, times sine of omega t plus theta. Right, so the things that we're left to solve for are that the phase of the sinusoidal oscillation may not be the same as the phase of the applied forcing term. Right, so there's some phase lag, theta. Likewise, the force is applied with some amplitude, but then the response of the position will have some other amplitude. I mean, you at least need to change units, right? Because the force has certain units and the position has other units. But then also, the intuition that you ought to have from Physics 1 is that in a system like this, there's some resonance to the way that this thing responds to a sinusoidal drive, right? And so those sorts of things are meant to be captured in M. So in this notation over here, it's perhaps not entirely clear, but the idea is that theta and M are things that depend very very closely on this driving frequency omega and how it compares to the resonant response frequencies of the system. So again, using some elementary techniques that we won't go over today, you can derive that the kind of complex response coefficient, so the magnitude gain m times e to the j theta, j is here is just the square root of minus 1, it has this sort of a Lorentzian form, which is written in terms of the response frequency of the system and the frequency of the drive. So the complete solution, as we were saying before, is the sum of the homogeneous and particular. So, for example, if we have a system where we both start the system off of its equilibrium, so we, say, push the mass in a little bit to compress the spring, and then maybe even, at time t equals zero, we let the thing have a little bit of velocity, and then we also apply the sort of a sinusoidal forcing term. If we want to get the overall response of the system, we have to add together this sort of a driven response, particular response, and then we add to that the homogeneous type of response that we got in the previous slide. But you see what happens, that as long as this damping term is non-zero, when we go to the long time limit, the homogeneous solution will damp away, right? And the only thing that we'll be left with is a sort of steady state solution given by the particular response. And that's kind of how it should be, right? So then in any damped system like this, if you wait long enough, it kind of forgets its initial conditions, all that information just sort of disappears into the damping. Okay, so those were the first two slides, just kind of reminding you of some general properties of second-order systems and the way that we like to deal with them. And again, second-order in that context refers to the fact that the highest time derivative appearing in the differential equation is a second derivative, right? And the reason why we have that second derivative is that in F equals ma, in Newton's law, a is the second derivative of some position. So, generally speaking, in control and dynamical systems and all those related fields, when you're writing down a dynamical model for some system, it's most useful to try to put those equations into what's called state-space form. And so the general way that we would represent that state-space form is that x here is actually supposed to be a vector of variables, right? It's the complete set of variables that you need in order to fully describe the dynamics of the system. Right, so in the previous slide, we saw that in order to fully describe everything, we needed q, q dot, and q double dot. Why do we need all these? Well, in order to compute the force of the spring, we needed q. In order to compute the force of the dashpot, we needed q dot. And in order to account for inertia, we needed q double dot. Right, so there in that case, even though we were just talking about a block mass moving in one dimension, we actually needed three variables to fully describe the dynamics. Right, so in this equation up the top here, x is supposed to stand, for instance, for like a vector of those three variables. So the dynamics is given in the form of dx dt is equal to some function, which could be even a nonlinear function, both of the variables that represent the phase space and also the any external forcing terms that you might need to have. So those are the sort of natural dynamics of the plant, but then for control purposes, you also usually want to talk about what the measured or observed variables are, and those are usually represented by a variable or a vector of variables called y. And so again, the output signals y are then determined as some possibly nonlinear function of the x's and u's. For the most part, what we're going to deal with in CDS 110, though, is linear dynamical systems. And linear means that you constrain the right-hand side of this form to only depend linearly on the dynamical variables and the controls. So in full generality, what you end up with then is a matrix equation where you have ddt of the vector of variables is equal to some matrix A times that same vector plus some possibly matrix B or possibly vector B times the set of control signals U. Likewise, the outputs, the measured variables from the system, is again determined as some matrix times the vector of dynamical variables plus some other matrix times the set of controls U. So, these variables X, so these are the things that represent the state of the system. And for an nth order system, we're talking about having n such variables. And let's see. So for instance, I messed this up a little bit. So if we compare with the example on the previous slide, that was a second order system, right? So you expect that the state X should be a thing that lives in R2, right, according to this notation. How does that go? Well, what you can see is that the phase space variables are actually X and X dot, and the X double, Q and Q dot, and the Q double dot appears when you take DDT of Q dot. Right, so that's why that thing is a second order system. So U and Y are in general also allowed to be vectors, although again, in a class like CDS110, you'll generally just deal with single input, single output systems, which is to say that you usually set this dimension P to 1 and also that dimension Q to 1. So a nice thing to see, which relates back to the example of the first two slides, is that if you have a higher order linear ODE, you can always convert that thing into a first order set of linear ODEs. And we like to do that just because it simplifies all the math and representations of things. So for instance, if you're faced with an equation that looks like this, and note that our mass spring damper system fits into this form, where you have some whole set of derivatives of a configuration variable Q with some coefficients that enter in there. Now, those things are all summed together on the left-hand side and set equal to some forcing term on the right-hand side. Right? U is an input, like the forcing term. And then if the way that you determine the output signal Y is, again, by taking some linear combination of configuration variable and various time derivatives of it, you can always convert that into a strictly first-order form. Right? Here, this is implicitly a first-order-looking kind of differential equation. And the simple way that you do that is just define a set of new variables. So even though, in the mass spring damper, we only really had one configuration variable, just the position of the mass. But then if you take the position of the mass and the velocity, right, then we see that when we put those into a vector and take ddt, we're allowed to have an equation that reads q double dot is equal to some stuff, right? Because, if we had q and q dot, then ddt of q dot is going to give us a q double dot, which we can then set equal to stuff on the right-hand side, which is a linear combination of other things. Right, so if we look at this equation, we can just rearrange this a little bit, and that says if we just divide this whole thing through by m, we'll have ddt of q dot is equal to f over m minus c over m q dot minus k over m q. Right, so we can get all that stuff on the right-hand side, and that's obviously of this form, in the sense that if we have a ddt of q dot here, then this term here can represent the c over m q dot and the k over m q. And then the forcing term appears in here through u. Right, so just by using that trick of just kind of defining new phase space variables, which are equivalent to derivatives of the actual configuration variables, you can always take a higher order ODE of that form and put it into the state space form, which looks like a first order system. And the only thing to note, which is a little bit tricky, is so, for instance, in this vector here, if the bottom guy happens to be Q, this guy here, let's say, is Q dot, so then in the equations of motion, we're going to have ddt of Q dot, and the thing that we want to get out of this row of the A matrix times the same vector is that this is going to be the actual equation of motion. But what's going on down here? Well, you just need another line that says that ddt of Q is equal to Q dot. Right, but we can just do that by sticking in a row here that's zeros, but then a 1 in the place that multiplies the q dot term over there. Right, and so if I happen to have a 15th order ODE or whatever, we can just always do that by putting the equation of motion in the row that corresponds to the highest derivative, and then we just get these ones in there to just represent the fact that ddt of d to the fourth q dt to the fourth is equal to d to the fifth q dt to the fifth. That kind of stuff. Okay. So one of the reasons why we like to deal with these linear first-order systems is that in principle it's always possible to get analytic solutions of those ODEs. Basically, it's linear algebra, and in reality, it's pretty messy. If you even go up to 3x3 systems, it's already pretty messy. 2x2 systems you can really generally deal with. If you have numerical problems and you're willing to deal with numerical answers, then you can deal with really very large things. So I think what we do here is to kind of motivate the general form of the solution by looking at kind of a trivial example. But Richard said that he's going to get back to the full solution method later in the class. So the basic intuition to rely upon is what you hopefully remember about scalar first-order differential equations, right? So if we have, if x now is just a scalar variable, if we write down an equation that looks like x dot is equal to ax plus u, and now a is just a number, right? So this is really just x dot is equal to ax. We can immediately write down what the homogeneous solution looks like, right? It's just that x of t is equal to e to the at times x naught. This is the homogeneous part, right? So this is what we get if we want to consider the effect of the initial condition x naught in setting this external driving term to zero. Hopefully everybody remembers how to do this. It's basically just, you know, you ignore u. So you take this equation, turn it into dx over x is equal to a dt. Integrate both sides, you get log of x over here, and you get at over here. Exponentiate both sides, and then you end up with that thing. Right. But then even if you have a driving term, it's very easy to then add in the particular solution. So for example, in this kind of an equation, if you want to consider the effect of a sinusoidal driving term, a sine omega 1t, it's quite straightforward to derive that this is the overall effect. The basic way that you do that is to show that in this kind of a first-order linear differential equation with additive driving, right, the general solution, so here's the homogeneous term that we've already talked about, right, the idea being that this is x of t is equal to e to the some scalar t times x of 0, and then the other term that you need to stick in, that you just add on, so this thing represents the particular solution, and what it looks like is the so-called convolution integral, where we've got an integral from 0 to t, so from the initial time up to the current time, and you're integrating over the kind of history of this driving term, but then at every moment in the past that you're integrating over, you kind of bring this term up to date with an exponential of this form. We'll talk about a different interpretation on the last slide of the lecture, but kind of the way that I like to think about this is you can actually imagine in this exponential, you can of course separate this thing out, since these are all scalars. So you have an e to the lambda t that you can pull outside the integral, and then you have an e to the minus lambda tau that you're left with. Right? So in fact, if you pull that e to the lambda t out front here, it kind of looks like this homogeneous term and the particular term are being propagated forward in time in the same way. So how do you interpret this stuff in here? Well, at every point in time, from the initial time to the present time, you had some value of the driving function u. Now, if you take that value and hit it with e to the minus lambda tau, if you look at this form, well, that's basically actually just a thing that propagates that back to time zero. So it kind of asks, you know, for the driving term that you've inserted at time tau, that is actually equivalent to having changed somehow what the initial condition was by a little bit. And the way that you do that is just by hitting that u to the tau with this e to the minus lambda tau. And so you kind of refer all of the inputs back to what they would have been if they were initial conditions, add them up to the actual initial condition, and then propagate them all forward the same way. There's a different interpretation of that that we can get to on the last slide. Now, if x is a vector rather than a scalar, there's sort of one trivial case of that, which is what we call a decoupled system. And there the idea is, well, suppose that what you actually have is just a set of scalar linear differential equations that don't couple to each other at all. Then in that state space matrix kind of form, the way that that looks is you just stack all your variables into a vector x and say that ddt of that vector x is equal to some A matrix times x, but where that A matrix is diagonal. Right, so if that A matrix is diagonal, obviously you can just read off every row of that equation as a separate scalar equation, and everything just kind of goes through. You independently integrate each row and then shove the things back together. Now, the interesting case, the kind of non-trivial case, is when this A matrix is not diagonal. It may be full of off-diagonal terms. But there, in principle, since we have a linear first-order equation, it's still possible to write down kind of an in-principle analytic solution. And the general idea is that just as you want to take the exponential of the scalar that you have in that scalar case, somehow what you kind of want to do is take the exponential of this A matrix, right? And the basic tool that you need to use for that is you need to understand what it means to take the exponential of a matrix. Many of you have probably already seen that in linear algebra, and then Richard says that he's going to get to that a little bit later in the term. But it's basically just something you do by diagonalizing the matrix if you can, and then using that as a kind of a trick to do the exponentiation. I guess Richard's also going to talk about Jordan canonical form, which, if any of you are wondering, you can get into situations with this A matrix where the A matrix actually isn't diagonalizable. That makes it harder to calculate the matrix exponential, but there's still a different kind of thing that you can do where you still can calculate the matrix exponential. It's just not quite as straightforward. So, in general, though, if we were talking about the general state space form of a system like this, if it was not possible to rewrite things in this linear way, right? If we really had to have nonlinear functions on the right hand side, there are some special cases that are known where you can still obtain analytic solutions, but those are really pretty unusual. In the general case, there's not really anything analytic you can do. So in fact, in kind of modern applications, analytics isn't everything, right? If you've got a fast computer, it's often expedient and or informative to investigate numerically how your equations behave. Certainly, if the equations of motion that you have are nonlinear, numerical solution is often the only really good tool that you have for trying to understand the behavior of the system. But even in cases where your systems are linear, if they're very large or you just want to get a quick idea of what's going on, it's often not a bad idea to just use some numerics to see what's happening. So the basic idea of that is that, if you have something like dx dt, right, those are infinitesimals that you can never represent exactly in terms of a numerical calculation on a computer. However, you just note the fact that the way that this thing is really defined is dx dt is supposed to be some limit as epsilon goes to zero of x of t plus epsilon minus x of t divided by epsilon. Right, and so what that means is that as long as you're willing to settle for some finite numerical precision, you can always integrate those differential equations just by doing something where you just step discretely in time. So if you have some assignment of the variables x at time t, if you want to propagate them forward in time, even if the right-hand side of your equations is nonlinear, you can just say that x at t plus epsilon is equal to x of t plus epsilon times the right-hand side, which is the thing that's supposed to be equal to that dx dt. Right, our state space form was dx dt is equal to f of x and u. Right, so if you just plug f of x and u in over here and just assume that we don't actually have to take this limit, we can just pick some very small value for epsilon, then what you have is that x of t plus epsilon is equal to x of t plus epsilon times f of x and u. And the idea is that if you then just calculate this iteratively on a computer, as long as you choose epsilon sufficiently small, you get a reasonably good analytic solution, reasonably good approximation of the actual analytic solution. So, for instance, with linear equations, you can kind of see how fast this kind of process converges in the sense that you can try a problem where you know exactly how to integrate the thing analytically and then calculate what the response of the system is supposed to be, but then you can also go use this discrete stepping solution and compare how well you do versus the step size that's used. So I'm not exactly sure what this example is, but Richard took something and just tried. There's a dashed line under here, which you can't really see so much because it's pretty buried, but it's more or less under this red line. Right? So that's the actual solution for the equations of motion that you get analytically. Now, if you try something like this, where h was 1 in some units, then what you find is that you get this blue thing. And so the blue thing's not bad, right? It still pretty much tracks the dashed line underneath, but it's not a great approximation. And then this green circle line is with h is equal to a half, and then the actual red line is h is equal to 0.1. And so what you're supposed to see here is that the approximated solutions are kind of converging to the true analytic solution as the step size gets smaller and smaller. Now, this is kind of the most simple-minded way that you could use a computer to try to approximate the solution to some equations of motion, and there are lots of ways to do better than that. So, for instance, you can try to get better approximations to the derivative that, say, take things to higher orders in epsilon. And also, you can sometimes make more efficient numerical integration algorithms if you use the fact that, for some regions of the phase space, you really have to take very small steps to accurately track what's going on, whereas in other parts of the phase space, you may be able to get away with larger steps. And so the kind of fanciest algorithms that people use are adaptive step size, higher order numerical integrators. And a good example of that is the set of integrators that you find in MATLAB with things like ODE45, which is some Runge-Kutta method. And if you're interested in those, I think there's actually a pretty good explanation of them in some of the help files on MATLAB. Okay, so another thing that you can, one thing that you can do with this sort of numerical simulation, although this is also a good thing that you can do experimentally, is that you can characterize linear systems using their frequency response. So we were saying before that if we take a linear system such as this second-order system, and we drive the thing with a sinusoidal forcing term, we're going to find that the response of the system is also sinusoidal with the same frequency, just that we'll have some phase lag, which is depends on the driving frequency, and also there'll be some magnitude of the response, which is also a function of the frequency. So here I think what we have is something where you just put into a computer an integration of these differential equations, and you substitute in for f of t terms of this form. So I think what you do is keep a fixed at 1 or whatever, and then you just vary this frequency. So you can clearly see here the trajectories that result. So if we drive the thing at a very low frequency, the response is going to be at a low frequency. So here this dark blue long period thing is an example of that response. And it's got some amplitude of response that's something like, 1.3, 1.5. If we turn up the frequency a little bit, then I think we get to this red response. And so indeed the system responds at that higher frequency. And the amplitudes may be a little bit bigger, but about the same. I missed this cyan curve. So there's this cyan curve in the middle, and then the red curve. And so those are successively higher driving frequencies.
What happened to the W? Why is the thing dependent on the W, the omega, and not in the properties of the system?
Yeah. So, really the way that you should understand this is that the phase lag depends on the difference between this driving frequency and the natural response frequencies of the system. But if you keep those other, if you consider those other things to be fixed, then you just have to not forget that this thing is a function of omega. So then what you see in this green curve is that when you hit something which is close to the resonance frequency of the system, you get a pretty large amplitude of response. But then if you keep increasing the frequency beyond that, the magnitude of the response goes down again. You get this purple curve and again the other red curve. So the simple thing that you can do with these guys is first of all to just look at the steady state amplitude, right? And it really is a steady state amplitude in the sense that, especially on the resonant case, it takes a while for the system to equilibrate, comes to its steady state. But if you measure the magnitude of the response compared to the magnitude of the drive, then you can plot that as a function of frequency and get a typical resonant response curve like this. Right. The idea is the reason why the peak happens here is because that's some resonant frequency that's determined by M and K and C, and then the degree to which that response peaks up is also a function of those parameters. And so the phase shift is also something you can measure. Like, if this thing is really sine, then you can go in there and just, stick in the sinusoidal wave of the driving term and see if the sinusoid of the response is shifted by some phase. And so obviously if you, again, just wait for the transients to die out and then compare those two phases, that's another plot that you could put, say, underneath this guy. So I think what Richard had in mind was to kind of indicate this as a thing that you can do as a form of numerical analysis for looking at these equations. But it's also often very useful if you have some system in the lab and you want to try to model that system as a second-order linear system like that. And if you have some electrical input that you can drive with a sinusoid and you have some relevant response that you can measure, it's often very useful to construct these sorts of frequency response plots by literally driving the thing with a sinusoid, waiting for it to settle, and measuring the magnitude and the phase of the response. Let me skip to this slide just because it's while we're on that topic. So similarly, you could also, if you have a system in the lab, you could kind of learn about the parameters of that system by applying a step function to the input rather than a sinusoid. Right, and so the idea of this is that, as I was saying before, you have some system in the laboratory, and nobody really gives you the model of that system, right? I mean, it's sort of based on your physical intuition about how the thing works. You might say to yourself, well, I think it should be reasonable to model this thing as a second-order system. And then the question becomes, well, what values do you want to use for the parameters that appear in that model? Right? What do you use for K, M, and C, or B, or whatever you call it? And some of those things you can directly measure by weighing the thing or whatever. But some of them you might actually, it might be most convenient to try to estimate those things based on observations of the way the thing responds. Right? So obviously in the sinusoidal case, if you just stick sinusoids into the input and observe the response, you'll be able to tell kind of where the resonance frequency is. And so since you know how to express the resonance frequency in terms of the model parameters for a second order system, that's obviously that kind of a measurement is going to give you information about what those parameters are. Similarly, for something like a step response, we're saying that for the second order system, when you apply a step, kind of what you expect is that the response will overshoot a little bit, but then come back and eventually gradually kind of settle and ring down until the thing assumes some equilibrium displacement that depends on the magnitude of your force. So suppose that you actually, again, go and do that in the lab. So the idea is that as a function of time, you've applied some magnitude of a step function at the input. And so if you observe the actual response of the system and get some wiggly curve like this, something that you can pull out of analytic manipulation of the model is that if we look at the time interval between the first and second maxima in that response and call that thing capital T, it's actually related to the parameters of the model by this equation here. Likewise, the ratio of the these two maxima is given by this equation here, and then the equilibrium value of that thing, as we were saying before, is related to F0 over K. And so the spirit of this is that, well, where do these equations come from? They come from an analytic manipulation of the actual differential equations of motion for a second-order linear system. Now, this would be a curve that you would actually generate in the laboratory by literally taking the thing and hitting it with a step. But having measured that, you can then go in and get numbers for this ratio and a number for this time interval and a number for this equilibrium response and set them equal to these different expressions and by that approach solve for or kind of estimate or identify what parameters you ought to stick into a model, an equation that you want to use to model the response of the actual system that you have. Right, and so you can do this for a step response, you can do it for a ramp input, you can do it for an impulse input, you can do it for a sinusoid. You know, which one of those things is most useful tends to, you know, depends on the experimental situation you have. Okay, so one other thing that one often does with these sorts of differential equation models of a system, you know, whether it's something that you just wrote down off the top of your head or whether it's something that you identified based on experiments, is that you can use them to analyze certain stability properties of a system. So here we're going to look at a system, at an example where it's kind of easy to see what's going on, and what we're going to kind of just recover is exactly what your physical intuition would have told you. So if we go back to this mass spring damper system that we talked about for the first few slides, you kind of know that as long as this damping coefficient isn't zero, the system is stable, right? In the sense that it has some equilibrium condition, namely that the spring is at its equilibrium extension and the velocity is zero. And if we displace that thing away from that equilibrium condition, you know that the thing will start oscillating or whatever, but if you wait long enough, it's basically going to damp all the way back down to its equilibrium. So, but let's just see how that kind of qualitative stability property can be proven by analysis based on these on the differential equation model. So the kind of physical intuition you could use would be to say, well, let's look at how the energy evolves as a function of time. Right, so we know that for a mass on a spring, we can say that there's an energy function which is equal to the potential energy plus the kinetic energy. Right, so here 1/2 k x1 squared. X1 is a variable that we've just set actually equal to the position of this mass, and x2 is a variable that we set equal to the velocity. Right, so that's kinetic energy plus potential energy. So this energy function here is always positive. Right, because m and k are positive, and these are squares of things. And it's equal to zero at exactly one point, which is the equilibrium point of the system. Right, so if we go to the, if we set the spring at its equilibrium extension, that's defined to be the point at which the position is zero. Likewise, the velocity would have to be zero. Right, so this function, which in this context is called the Lyapunov function, has the property that it's positive everywhere except for one point where it's zero, and that's the equilibrium point of the system. So now what we can do is say, all right, now suppose that we just displace the system arbitrarily and then just let the thing go and see how it kind of regresses back to its steady state. So at its initial time, you know, we pull the thing out so that we give it some non-equilibrium position and velocity, and so we can evaluate the v of x there, and it'll have some value. And then if we just let the system go, right, the x1 and x2 are going to change as a function of time, and so kind of corresponding to that, the value of v, if we evaluate it in any later time, is also going to change. But a neat thing that we can do with the differential equation model is to ask, well, what is the time derivative of v? In fact, we can just find an equation for that, right? Because if v is equal to this thing, we take the time derivative of that. So that's we take the time derivative of the first term. This 2 comes down, and we get kx1 x1 dot. And then we get over here, this 2 comes down, kills that a half, so we get m x2 x2 dot. Right? So v dot is just equal to this thing. But then from the form of the equations of motion, if we've stuck them in the state space form, This is the position, so we know that the time derivative of the position is just the velocity. Likewise, the time derivative of the velocity is q double dot, but we can get that, you know, by solving this equation for q double dot. So if we stick that thing in there, we get this. And so then we just find that, well, so this term came from over here. We'll get an mx2 x1 with a minus k over m. That m cancels that m. So that term is minus k x1 x2, and that exactly kills that guy off. And then the only thing that we're left with here is minus b x2 squared. Right? So we actually find by combining this form of what the Lyapunov function is with the dynamics that we have for the system that the time derivative of v is this. Right, so since this is since b is positive, if that's actually damping, and x2 squared is a non-negative function, we find that what this says is that as a function of time, more or less, we expect this Lyapunov function to be decreasing in value. And so wherever we started, it started at some positive value. And if the thing is always decreasing, we kind of have no choice except to go all the way eventually to the origin. Now, the one thing that's a little bit tricky about this example, and so it's actually, in a way, it's not such a good example of Lyapunov stability, but although it's the typical case that you get for mechanical systems, the only thing that you can really infer from this equation, so v dot is equal to minus bx2 squared, what you can infer from that is that wherever you start out, x2 is going to go to zero. It kind of has to. It doesn't directly tell you anything about what's happening with x1, but if you use a slightly more complicated approach called the Lassalle invariance principle, then you can also show for this system that x1 also approaches zero. And if you kind of remind yourself of what those things mean, what you get immediately from this is that regardless of how you start, the velocity eventually goes to zero. But physically, even, you can just infer, well, that means that the position eventually goes to zero, too. Because suppose that your velocity came to zero somewhere other than the equilibrium position, you know that the spring would just start pulling you. And so it can't be the case that you end up settling in the long time limit to some condition that has zero velocity but not zero position. Okay. Right, so the last topic to get to, and this is just kind of qualitative stuff, is to note that differential equation models, or combinations of differential equations and algebraic equations for describing a control system, are often represented in terms of block diagrams, which are not mathematical, but they kind of help you keep track of the way that various things influence various other things. Right, so here, for example, is a block diagram of a cruise control system for a truck. And the differential equation model that you might write down is this guy here, right? Where you just have, if the position of the truck is x, its velocity is v, and its acceleration is a, then the simple Newton's equation that you would write down is the sum of the forces is equal to ma, or m dv dt. Right? So then we might say that the sum of all forces includes a contribution f, which is actually the force of the wheels turning on the ground that try to propel the truck forward. But then there may also be some disturbance forces, so things like air drag or a headwind, or also if you're on a hill, you have gravitational contributions to the force and whatever. So the idea of a cruise control system is that what you're actually trying to do is to keep the velocity constant. Right, and so in terms of this equation, your overall objective is going to be something like, well, you want to keep dv dt is equal to zero, and with v sitting at some value that you like. The challenge of that is that these disturbance forces are going to crop up, and then your job as a controller is going to be to adjust the force from the wheels turning on the ground to compensate for those disturbances. So obviously you have pretty much everything that you need right there already in the equations, but in order to kind of better visualize what's going on, it's often nice to write down these kinds of block diagrams. So we have that, say, some person who's driving the truck might decide what they think this reference velocity ought to be, and then that thing is input into the actual electronics that forms the controller for this cruise control. So in your car, you have these little buttons or whatever where you somehow tell the car what speed you want to be going at. The job of the controller, then, is to output some control signal, which then goes into an actuator of some kind, which includes all the stuff kind of between the cruise control electronics and the actual wheels. Right? So that involves the engine and the throttle. Also, there's some gears and wheels and things. And really, if we wanted to make a complete detailed model of how the truck actually works, we might have sort of mathematical representations of all these different elements. But in the end, somehow, the controller spits out a signal U, and through all this actual mechanical stuff, that turns into some force F. Right? And so probably one of the things we want to understand in good detail is if we have some time-varying u, how exactly does that turn into a time-varying f in terms of the actual force of the wheels on the ground? So this is the force of the wheels on the ground. We have to subtract from that the disturbance forces, like the wind and the gravitational things on hills and all that. So those forces act on the body of the car, and as a result, we get some actual velocity for the truck. And so that thing is then measured by a speedometer, and then that's the signal which comes back into the controller. And then obviously what the controller is doing is it's comparing this to that, and then based on the difference, it's deciding what to output as its signal U. But in this whole block diagram, right, so the kind of details of exactly how this signal U here turns into a force there, right, those are the kind of, that's all the mathematics that you want to use in doing the best possible job to design the actual behavior of that controller. So in a block diagram like that, some blocks represent dynamics, right? They have things like inertia or whatever. Some of those blocks are just algebraic relations, like gears and things like that. Or, you know, they can be other sorts of complicated things. So standard block diagram notations that you have, so there's a summing junction, so it's usually written like that. That just means that two signals come together and you add them. A gain block is another common thing, which just says a signal comes in from the left, you multiply it by a number, and that gives you the signal to the right. You might have a saturation block, saying that you might have some elements in your system where even if U ranges over a very wide range, there may be some kind of limits on the output of that block where it gets cut off on the top side and the bottom side. You could have an integrator. That's this thing here. So maybe that you have some signal that gets integrated before the thing comes out. Some more general sort of input-output system. And in fact, sometimes you may even have nonlinear maps from the input to the output. So, you know, these are common ways that those things would be represented graphically. And also, like in the MATLAB Simulink package, you can even kind of design dynamical systems by just hooking together blocks. And just a little note, the notation is similar to this, but it's a little bit different in some places. So let me just show you this one example, just because it's a really cool example. So the idea of this is sort of, so this is some project that I have to admit, I don't know a whole lot about this project, but the basic idea is to try to design some sort of mesoscale robot, which would like to be a thing which actually flies and is an autonomous little flying robot. And the inspiration for trying to do this is to look at the way that flies fly. And I think the point of this movie, which hopefully will work, is to show you that flies are actually very amazing kind of air vehicles. Like if you look at the performance of a fly, it's really amazing to think that a tiny little thing like that, that really doesn't have very many internal parts, that it can perform so well. Because the performance that you see just any old housefly exhibiting as a flight vehicle, it's way beyond the capability of anything that you really know how to design. So a lot of what's going on these days in bioengineering and mechanical engineering in general is to try to actually reverse engineer what goes on in something like a fly, try to understand the general control principles that the thing uses, and then try to build mechanical systems that mimic that to see if you can sort of learn from biology and learn to make better flight craft. So I'm not sure if this particular block diagram is meant to literally represent the previous slide, but the idea of it is just that even if you want to think about something like a fly, right, where you really maybe have only very crude models of how some of these components work, it's still useful to write these things down in a block diagram kind of form, in the sense that you can have something where, okay, so if there's some velocity that you're trying to establish, there's, you know, let's say the velocity is coming out here on the signal. This signal somehow represents the way that the thing is actually moving, and now the fly needs to be able to kind of tell which directions it's moving, and so the vision system responds to its motion through space in some particular way. That information then goes, gets coupled with something from the kind of sensory system of the fly trying to understand which way it's oriented and all that. Then control signals go back to the actual moving parts of the fly. There's various aerodynamics that happen, so maybe this is supposed to resemble the truck. Remember that this block on the truck, was kind of the wheels turning on the ground. Here, I guess it's the wings flying through the air. You then have to superimpose on that some disturbance forces like drag, and those things then go into determining how the body moves, and you've got these control loops like that. But just as a kind of neat thing to look at the end of class, I believe what this thing is showing you is, here's the fly. Right, it's sitting on the end of this little tube or whatever. Not exactly sure what that is. But something happens just as the movie starts, which startles the fly and gets it to try to take off. And so the takeoff is not like, you know, if you've ever watched a bird take off, what they tend to do is they sort of stretch up and stretch their wings and just, you know, they just go up. What the fly does, I guess, in order to maybe avoid getting swatted and stuff, it's going to jump. Right, so it's going to use its legs to jump into the air, and that jump is not going to be a nice straight jump. It's actually going to send it almost tumbling and creaming off in some direction. But despite the fact that this thing is now kind of tumbling through space as it's flapping its wings, it very quickly is able to sort of right itself and gain control of what's going on and then continue off on some purposeful trajectory. So let's see if this movie actually works. Yeah, there it goes. Here's the jump. And you note that it wasn't a very smooth jump, at least the thing kind of tumbling around. But it doesn't take that long for the thing to kind of catch itself. Right, that was some countable number of flaps of its wings. And it's a little bit out of focus, but you can see that now it's pretty much under control, and it's able to take off and keep going. Now, if you can imagine a helicopter doing something like that, or you take the helicopter, you launch it up into the air with a catapult, the thing is kind of rolling over and all that, you're not going to be able to do that with a normal helicopter. So it's interesting to kind of look at something like a housefly, trying to understand what the basic elements are that it uses in the kind of system sense, right? So if you can sort of categorize all the parts of the fly and understand what blocks they contribute to in the overall signal flow, then that's the start of being able to kind of reverse engineer that and think about obtaining similar performance in a machine. Is there a question?
Yeah, I was curious whether that one flapping is real-time or whether that was getting blurred by the camera.
No, so I believe that's real-time flapping. So this is a very high-speed motion video. So those are the literal wing flaps of the fly. Okay, so that's all I'm going to go over today. I guess information about whatever you need is on the webpage.